Hi everybody, just a quick note that this episode was recorded before the news of the terrible terrorist attack in Moscow. So obviously we don't talk about that, and in fact we do have some stories that are critical about the Russian government, but we just want to take a moment to say that obviously our heart goes out to the innocent civilians who were affected by the terrorist attack. The footage I've seen is pretty brutal. People being machine gunned to death is not good at all. And I hope that over the next few weeks we find out who is responsible for the terrorist attack and that there is proper justice for that. So please bear that in mind as you listen to this episode, because obviously we had no idea what was going to happen that happened. So no doubt we will be covering the terrible events in Moscow in a future episode as more information comes to light. So on that note, I will now start the episode as planned. Thank you for listening.
Secrets and Spies presents Espresso Martini with Chris Carr and Matt Fulton.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Espresso Martini. Matt, how are you doing?
Hi, Chris. I'm good. It's good to be back. Yeah.
Feels like a while now.
I know.
It hasn't been that long, but it does feel like a while.
I think we've said that at the opening of the last episode, too.
I think we did, yeah. Because that was the first week of March.
Yes.
And then we decided last week probably wasn't a good idea, because then we still have another 2 weeks of March to go, because March is a 5 week month.
Yeah, March was weird.
So here we are today. So there we are.
Yes.
And on that note, so today we've got some interesting topics. We've got Russia potentially using nukes in Ukraine during 2022. We've got spies whining and dining in Brussels. And there's a good restaurant recommendation with that one. And then we've got Russia setting up fake news sites and more. And then on our Patreon-only show, Extra Shot, we're going to look at how to run a CIA station abroad, SAS soldiers accused of murder, and reports that the king has died, and more.
Fun stuff.
It is. And to get access to our show, Extra Shot, you'll need to be a Patreon subscriber. So just go to patreon.com/secretsandspies and pick the subscription level that works best for you. So, Matt, if you don't mind, we will start with your piece about how the US prepared for a potential Russian nuclear strike in Ukraine during 2022.
Yeah, so this is from a piece that was written up on CNN's website. It's by Jim Sciutto, one of their like sort of big national security correspondents. But the name of the article is US prepared rigorously for potential Russian nuclear strike in Ukraine in late 2022, officials say. So here's some key points. So, yes, in late 2022, the U.S. intensely prepared for a potential Russian nuclear strike on Ukraine, a concern sparked by Russia's deteriorating position in the conflict. This is according to details from Jim Sciutto's new book, The Return of Great Powers. It's, I believe it's already been published by now. It was published earlier in the month. At least
Looked quite interesting.
Yeah. At least in the U.S. I'm not sure about elsewhere, but in the U.S., at least it was published earlier this month. Anyway. So the Biden administration specifically feared Russia might employ tactical or battlefield nuclear weapons, prompting unprecedented contingency planning. Multiple factors contributed to the heightened alarm, including sensitive intelligence and the possibility of significant Russian losses in Ukraine. This is around the time that, like, the Ukrainians were pushing to recapture Kherson, another territory in the east. It was timed with those offensives. Russian propaganda about a Ukrainian dirty bomb raised suspicions of a potential cover for a nuclear attack. Western intelligence intercepted communications among Russian officials discussing a nuclear strike, raising concerns further. Despite no clear signs of imminent nuclear mobilization by Russia, U.S. officials remained unsure about detecting tactical nuclear weapons movements. Urgent diplomatic outreach, including direct communications with Russian officials and coordination with allies, aimed to deter a nuclear strike. Efforts to enlist the support of China and India were made to dissuade Russia from nuclear escalation, we believe. While the immediate threat subsided with a period of relative stalemate in the conflict, vigilance persists with ongoing refinement of plans amid the possibility of future nuclear strikes. Chris, what did you think about this?
Yeah, very, very interesting piece. And it kind of filled in a few gaps about that period of time. Because I remember the reports of the Russian false flag and the fears that they would use a nuke and blame it on a Ukrainian dirty bomb. So that makes a lot of sense. One quote that stood out in the article for me was, "I don't think many of us coming into our jobs expected to be spending significant amounts of time preparing for a scenario which a few years ago was believed to be from a bygone era." And that was a senior administration official said that to the author of the piece. And so, yeah, I mean, it's I had an interesting conversation with a taxi driver, which you'll hear more about in my episode next week with Dr. Taras Kuzio. And this particular taxi driver sort of had this very kind of post-colonial and far-left view on the conflict in Ukraine, and somehow ultimately everything was NATO and America's fault. And what this article kind of shows quite interestingly is how NATO and America went out of its way to avoid any kind of direct conflict with Russia of this situation. They used a lot of diplomatic and behind-the-scenes methods to try and dissuade Russia from using any nuclear weapons. Another thing that stood out a little bit as well was the fact that there are some tactical nukes that are so low yield that there was a question about whether or not they would even be detected. I thought that was quite interesting, because when you think of a tactical nuclear weapon, you still think of Hiroshima or something like that, you know, in your mind, your mental picture, that always sort of comes up. And I remember back in 2022, around that time, seeing some of those US nuke sniffers, the WC-135R, flying around Poland, and when those planes come out, it's always like, oh, what's that looking for and stuff. So was it looking for these potential low yield nuclear weapons being used? So yeah, no, I thought that was very good. What else on there? And then I wanted to sort of try and understand what the US response was going to be, because obviously they don't really say in the article what it is. So I had a quick look around, and there was an article back from 2022 where David Petraeus, who was a former army general, basically said the US and its allies would destroy Russian troops and equipment in Ukraine, and it would sink the entire Black Sea fleet, which is quite a dramatic thing, actually, because that would then be America in a direct confrontation with Russia. So you could see how this could all escalate. And we've been saying for quite some time now about, I've always been concerned that this could end up turning into a kind of World War III terrible situation where people are firing nukes at each other. And it just shows, if Russia had dropped the tactical nuke, how things could have escalated if America had then attacked the Black Sea Fleet and then Russia perceived that as a direct threat on themselves. So you can see how these things kind of can escalate and get out of control. So it was, I think what this article kind of shows quite well is how the success of the Biden administration in its diplomatic efforts to kind of stop this from happening, and using China and India to do that. I thought that was really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. One thing that sort of stood out to me from this piece was the thought that, like, the false flag operation, right, that the Russians were supposedly planning. And I had the thought that, like, either using a straight up dirty bomb, which is like radiological material with conventional explosive used to disperse the material over, you know, an area, or a low yield nuclear weapon to the, like, in like the 1 to 10 kiloton range.
Yep.
Probably significantly smaller than 10 kilotons, probably closer to the 1 kiloton or even the sub-kiloton yield, would look in practice like the explosion from that wouldn't be like, it wouldn't be like what you would see in like a nuclear test from like the Cold War. Nothing even close to that. It would look, especially when you get to the kiloton level and below, the explosion to the thing that you would see, right? Because you're not going to see the radiation. You may see people with radiation poisoning, but you're not going to see the radiation that you would just get from a dirty bomb, right? The explosion that you would get from a 1 kiloton or sub-kiloton yield weapon would look similar to just a conventional explosion, right? You wouldn't have the big, the flash and the heat and the mushroom cloud and, you know, all the like shockwave. You wouldn't get that as much, right?
Yeah.
And I thought, in that scenario, if you're trying to pass this off as a Ukrainian quote-unquote dirty bomb. That, to me, is easier to exploit in a disinformation environment than using a, you know, higher yield kind of weapon, you know? Especially because, like, if you, I don't know, if you light off something in the 10 kiloton plus, you know, going up to the size of what Hiroshima or Nagasaki, what those bombs were, right? That's an intensely visual thing that you can't really then spin up your disinformation bullshit machine and say, oh, it was the Ukrainians, it was, you know, whatever, right? Because you can see it. Anyone can see that and know that's a nuclear explosion, right?
Well, do you remember that big explosion in Beirut at the port that everybody thought was a nuclear explosion because it looked like one, but it wasn't one.
That was a dark day for me, so, for reasons I don't want to go into, but
okay,
because of that explosion, but
but so I think a lot of people, I suppose, if it looks like a conventional explosion, I mean, I think, if you because it would require a certain bit of hardware that would be less likely Ukraine would have to set off a big bomb.
Right. I mean, that what happened in Beirut was, I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but it was like thousands of pounds, the equivalent of thousands of pounds of TNT. What you saw was, what you saw was equivalent to a larger size tactical nuclear weapon that would lack like the heat, the thermal radiation that a nuke would give off, you know? But going back to what I thought about like the disinformation thing, it would just be a lot easier to launder that through your own Russian channels or through, you know, useful idiots and bad actors in the West as to create the air of plausible deniability if it was just a radiological event. You know, does that make sense what I'm saying? That sort of the difference in the way that it's visual. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That just stood out to me as a very kind of insidious way to go about irradiating, you know, an entire Ukrainian division. But
the other story that came out was that the Ukrainians were going to blow up one of their power stations. That was the other one. And again, that kind of. So if Russia targets a power station, like how what the form the remains of Chernobyl, I don't know what would happen if you took that out. Cause it...
Well, there's that one in southern Ukraine. It's right on the Dnipro River. There's a firefight at that power plant relatively early on in the war. The name escapes me right now, but that's sort of been like right on the front lines.
And the danger of power cuts to that power station, which then means it can't cool down properly, which could then lead to disaster. That's the scary thing actually. Some of these things is doesn't even need to be a weaponized nuke. It could just be somebody does something stupid near a power station, and it all gets out of hand. You know, it's
The other thought I had here that said, even smaller yield nuclear weapons, they're relatively easy to detect through technical means, through technical collection means. I mean, yes, the point that the smaller the yield gets, the harder it is to detect, especially when you're talking about like a dirty bomb. But those units, like those depots where such weapons are held, are watched like a hawk. I mean, the sort of treaty regimes and stuff that we've had in place since the end of the Cold War are kind of gradually being shredded right now. But I mean, there's all kinds of measures in place to monitor those facilities. During the Cold War, the Soviets, the actual warheads were controlled by the KGB, whereas like the missiles, you know, that kind of stuff, those were in the hands of like the Red Army, right? Or the Strategic Rocket Force. But the warheads themselves were controlled by the KGB. And now I think it's there's a main directorate inside the Ministry of Defense. I want to say off the top of my head, it's a 12th main directorate. But don't quote me on that. Anyway, it's a directorate inside the Ministry of Defense that has this role now. It's not under, you know, the FSB or something. But you would see, we would pick up that transfer and that chain of custody between like the warheads being moved out of their depot, you know, or this unit suddenly linking up with this unit that's deployed inside Ukraine or near Ukraine. That stuff would be detected. And this is stuff that would set off alarm bells for NATO, but it would also, it would require us to, seeing those kind of weapons in play would require the Pentagon to increase our own defensive posture across the entire U.S. military, right? Like you would have that like DEFCON level. That's where that stuff would come into play. And you would have like the hotline in the National Military Command Center that would go call up to the general staff in Moscow, like, what the hell are you guys doing? The other concerning thing there is like the Overton window is often used to describe like political ideologies and where like the center is on a particular issue, right? But you also look at, I don't know, like an Overton window on the acceptability of weapons of mass destruction, right? Each time they get used, that Overton window, if you will, shifts a little bit, right?
Like, yeah, there's no consequence.
Right.
Yeah.
When there's no consequence, this is Obama's red line in Syria. Chemical weapons were used in Syria and there was kind of no real consequence. And now it's the next time a dictator uses chemical weapons in a conflict. It's not as big of a deal because it's been done before, right? So if you then have the Russians sort of doing it that like you can use some sort of radiological device or even a low yield tactical battlefield nuclear weapon, which, you know, in the 50s and 60s, the 50s especially, it was sort of thought that like nukes would just be casually used in war, you know, like we were changing the structure of U.S. Army divisions to operate in these isolated sort of semi-autonomous battle groups so that like one of them could get wiped out by a tactical nuke, but, you know, the whole rest of your force wouldn't. Like we were changing the way that we did warfare to accommodate this and then smartly realized, OK, no, that's insane. You know, we're just going to dial it back so that it's so taboo that like you don't even touch these weapons. Right. They're there for deterrence, you know, but. Yeah. If Putin and the Russians, you know, light off some kind of radiological device or small, low-yield tactical nuke in Ukraine, it makes it a whole lot more likely that, you know, Kim Jong-un will say, okay, why don't I use it against Japan or the South Koreans? Or the Chinese are going to say, Taipei, you have, you know, 48 hours to surrender Taiwan or we're going to, you know, nuke this facility. You know, you get to that kind of brinksmanship that hostage taking. Like I said, it just moves the Overton window to a place where the use of these weapons are more tolerated, I want to say. And I think, like you're talking about Petraeus's article that, you know, it's, I think, making the costs of the use of those weapons very clear, like what we said, you know, we'll destroy your invasion force, we'll destroy the Black Sea Fleet. And then, you know, if you want to, if you, the Russians, want to walk away at that point, that's okay. If not, you know, you ratchet up the escalation ladder until you're talking about the extinction of the human race, you know? Yeah, I think it's making the cost of that use very clear. And it's also, I mean, the Russians, when they, even before they invaded Ukraine, they wanted to do some false flag kind of operation to give them a pretext to do so, tried repeatedly several different plans. And, you know, the Biden administration, I think very smartly, strategically declassified our intelligence on that stuff and sort of named and shamed these efforts. You know, like, we know what you're doing. It's not going to work. And, you know, the Russians ultimately just sort of invaded, right? There was no sort of false flag pretext.
Yeah, I mean, the whole war is on a pretext of nonsense because it's the Russians are saying they're going in to liberate the Russian-speaking Ukrainians from neo-Nazis.
Right, but you didn't have, like, in the opening days of the war, you didn't have, like, a supposed attack by Ukrainian forces inside Russia or against a Russian-speaking population inside Ukraine that then Putin could go out and say, hey, we got to invade to defend Russian speakers, you know, the Russian diaspora. That didn't happen, not because they didn't want to, but because we blew the operation. And I think that's ultimately what we did here.
Yeah, because Putin did it with Chechnya, didn't he? He blew up the apartment block.
Allegedly.
Yes. Allegedly. But it's an interesting one, that one, because over the years, even I was a bit like, because it kind of got into that 9/11 kind of truther territory for me. And for a while, I was very skeptical of those claims, but I've spoken to so many people who, people like Edward Lucas and things like that, who take it as a fact. I'm like, wow. Yeah. So it really does seem to be a given that he did do that. There's some interesting stuff there.
Those attacks, which was the pretext for the second Chechen War, what sort of happened, it was like, what, in like 2000, right?
I think, yeah, it was either 99 or 2000. It was very early in Putin's...
Yeah, that was at a time that, like, I mean, such sort of dark conspiracy, false flag stuff. It was the realm of like B Hollywood movies still.
Yeah.
You know, it's not so much the case now.
No. Yeah. And Litvinenko was the one who pushed that theory in the West when he came here. I still haven't read his book, actually, but is it called Blowing Up Russia or something, isn't it? And it does talk about the FSB operation that allegedly blew up those apartment blocks. But
the cornerstone of Russian foreign policy has always been to create a crisis and then step in and volunteer to solve it. You know?
Yeah. And you can see how their talking points for Ukraine are a bit like that, with this whole fake neo-Nazi thing. That's, you know, it's so funny. There's still people on the far left who believe that, you know, and this taxi driver I met in London.
Yeah.
Who believe that still, even after all that's happened.
If that's your media diet, if you're like, you know, I don't trust the mainstream media, you know, I'm going to do my own research, which is basically, we're going to talk about this in a bit more, but is basically code for I'm going to Google until I find something that says what I want to believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're really prone to that kind of thinking.
Yeah, definitely. What is it, going against conventional wisdom feels sometimes...
It feels like you're smart when you do it.
It does, yeah. But in reality, 9 times out of 10, it's not true.
You're not that smart.
No, exactly. I thought that was a very interesting piece. It kind of helped put some reasoning behind some of the things that were going on back then, you know, in such recent history.
Yeah. I would say that we're not done with this, and I've said on here repeatedly, again, like, because of our own issues in Congress right now, this is not on the table right now at all, but when Crimea comes into play, that's when it's going to get dangerous.
Yeah. Because this is the thing, isn't it? Because I think every bit of land that Russia successfully manages to hold on to and take as their own is going to be much harder to get back.
Oh, yeah. I think we've talked about here before that, you know, whenever the Ukrainians decide that they want to come to the negotiating table, they better be damn certain that about when they do it. Because whatever territory the Russians hold at that time, it's going to be next to impossible to get it back.
Yeah, indeed. So, we'll keep an eye on this situation. And without a doubt, I'm sure we will be talking about this topic again very soon. I just hope we don't glow in the dark as a result of it, but there we go.
Yeah. I'm a little pale. I could, you know.
Bad nuclear joke there.
Yeah.
Oh dear. Well, let's move to Brussels, which, I don't know, is Brussels cheerier? It probably is a little bit, because Brussels has nice restaurants and things. So it's a sort of slightly nicer place. It's where you would do your kind of finer dining kind of espionage.
I've had a few lovely meals in Brussels. I remember walking into like the old city center there for the first time. It was sort of like early evening in the spring, sort of late spring night. It was lovely.
Cool. I mean, if I was an intelligence officer, the places would be my vibe would be like Brussels, Vienna, Copenhagen, maybe somewhere in Canada, New York. That's my kind of place to go spying. Anywhere else, not so interested, but... Yeah. And clearly I'm not alone in this. So apparently, according to the Belgian justice minister, Brussels is facing pervasive espionage threats. The city hosts key international institutions and numerous diplomatic missions. And the espionage risks come from Russia and China and some other countries as well. And their efforts have sort of escalated. So apparently... the reason is Brussels boasts 175 diplomatic missions and 150 international bodies in the city, so it makes a prime target for espionage, people wanting to know what diplomats are thinking, etc. Now, exact figures on how many spies are operating in the city is not available, but Belgian intelligence sources speak of several hundred spies being at work in Brussels. The spies work undercover and operate typically as journalists, lobbyists, foreign students, and diplomats. Obviously, diplomatic status offers spies the best protection as they possess immunity from prosecution. So that's why you get expulsions every so often rather than arrests. Interestingly as well, it's not just Russian and Chinese spies are active in the city. You also have Rwandan and Congolese spies who are apparently extremely active in the area. And without a doubt, MI6 would have been very active in Brussels during the Brexit negotiations. And I think all EU members would have active espionage efforts going on in Brussels as well. So it's a very crowded city. It's probably a lot going on. It's probably a bit like Vienna, where it's very hard not to bump into an intelligence officer or an asset somewhere. Probably gets a bit awkward sometimes. So Belgium is now trying to double down on its efforts by doubling its security staff and prioritizing counterintelligence over counterterrorism, because like with elsewhere, counterterrorism has been the priorities for some time. It will be interesting to see now with obviously the post-October the 7th, whether there will be a resurgence of Islamist extremism and terrorism. And certainly there's still growing threats on the far right. So we've got to be careful not to turn a blind eye to counterterrorism to then focus on counterintelligence. And then also in Belgium, it's very difficult to use the law to punish spies because you don't want to, because when classified information has been stolen, you don't want then that classified information to be read out in court as evidence. So they are looking at ways to adjust the laws in Brussels to make it a little bit easier to arrest and charge people for espionage. And then just on a final note, in 2019, the head of Austria's domestic intelligence agency said that Brussels has now overtaken Vienna in terms of the sheer number of agents from the so-called intelligence services from outside the EU. So yeah, Brussels is the place to be. Could be a very good spy destination if you want to go for some spy tourism this year. But just be careful not to act like a spy because you might get arrested. So Matt, over to you. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, Brussels is a target-rich environment. You consider all that's there. It's very interesting, the point you made about MI6 during the Brexit negotiations and stuff. And I'm sure there's a very interesting story there to be told.
Oh, I definitely believe so. I remember talking to Calder Walton about that ages ago, because we were briefly talking about MI6 in the age of Brexit, and obviously that would have been a massive priority. And it'd be interesting as an MI6 officer how you would feel about that, because I know for myself I'd feel very conflicted because I was very anti-Brexit. So then if my job was to spy on whoever to find out what they're thinking.
Honestly never thought of that until you just mentioned it in this segment, and it's like that's an obvious target. Of course they're doing that. Yeah. Anyway, as far as like, I mean, this article is specifically about Belgium, but I think this is true of many Western countries. I mean, like, it's sort of surprising how Belgium and others, I mean, and even the U.S. is guilty of this to an extent, has just completely dropped the ball here from a counterintelligence perspective. And it's almost like willfully naive to the threats they face, you know? And I think that like, just because we don't want to do the hard work of countering our adversaries does not mean that they won't do the hard work of countering us. In this day and age, to not have like the legal authorities to prosecute these espionage cases, like why? Like why are you just unilaterally just disarming, just tying your hands behind you? Like why?
Yeah.
You know? A lot of the biggest intelligence targets in Belgium are these supranational organizations, right? Like NATO or the EU, you know, and that is certainly asking a lot of a small country like Belgium and their domestic security services to handle all of the intelligence threats facing, you know, the EU and NATO. I don't know. Maybe that means that, you know, I know the EU has like a... They're like, what, European External Action Service, which is essentially their, like, kind of in-house spy agency. I think they mostly just do analysis, not really operations, as far as I know.
Okay. They don't do counterintelligence. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they need a to beef that up to handle a counterintelligence mission protecting their officers and their assets inside Brussels. You know, maybe NATO has an office of security that definitely does counterintelligence stuff. I don't know how big or aggressive it is, but maybe there needs to be some sort of an effort along these Western alliances to increase their own counterintelligence efforts that are being targeted inside Belgium. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. It's sort of been an open secret, like especially with NATO, of Russian spies managing to penetrate it and stuff. It's almost got to the point where now we're in a situation like with Ukraine and how that could escalate. It's in a situation now where the idea of a conflict with Russia is less theoretical and more possible. Obviously, everybody wants to avoid it. But the point of security is that your adversary doesn't know what your capabilities are. And because that, in the end, if they know what you're going to do in advance, then your said enemy can counter it. And obviously, Ukraine's intelligence successes have probably, helped Ukraine. They've certainly prolonged the so-called three-day war, because Russia thought initially this was going to be a cake run or cake walk. And they were going to be able to kind of get into Kyiv within a couple of days, you know.
Those paratroopers, yeah, they're airborne troops on that, like that first sort of push towards Kyiv. They packed their dress uniforms for a parade through Kyiv. They totally thought that they were just going to mop up.
Yeah. And to be fair, it kind of felt it was going to go that way. And I know that weekend when it all kicked off, even I thought, I think Ukraine's done for. And I was very...
Yeah, I thought it was just going to be an insurgency for years.
Yeah. And I would say, it's the wrong way to put it, but I'd say I was pleasantly surprised it didn't go that way. I can't think of a better way to put that.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm glad it didn't go that way. Yeah. I'm glad Ukraine have fought back. I'm just sorry that, in a way, at the moment, the West is slightly letting them down and could have done more to... Because every day it carries on, more and more Ukrainians are dying. That's the reality of it, isn't it? So that's the nasty side of all this. I've got a few more points I was going to throw up about Brussels, but is there anything else you want to add about Brussels, Roy?
No, let's hear what you got.
Yeah, well, so when Googling spies in Brussels, you'll realize quite quickly that this is not particularly new. And one thing that made me chuckle, military.com named Brussels the den of spies. That did make me chuckle a little bit. So obviously this has been an ongoing problem. Belgium are now trying to step up and deal with it. But there was a particular... So I want to give you a restaurant recommendation. Now, Matt, you may have been to this restaurant, but there's a particular restaurant that apparently was a hotbed of espionage. The owner was surprised and shocked by this and has denied this. It's not 100% proven that there are spies that go in here, but the restaurant was alluded to in an alert that was issued by the EU to diplomats to say to avoid the steakhouse that was within walking distance of the EU headquarters. And according to the owner, the only steakhouse in walking distance was his steakhouse, which is called Meat Steak and Wine House. So I had a look of TripAdvisor about this place. I thought, okay, I want to check this out. And it has a 4.5 star rating on TripAdvisor. And it offers some good looking food. The place itself looks quite small. And there was one review in 2022 that complained that they had a noisy lunch and it was tightly packed, which may make it tricky for covert conversations. Or that might go in your favor. I don't know. Because if it's so loud, maybe nobody can hear you. And obviously, if people are in close proximity, you can kind of recognize if the spy from China is trying to eavesdrop on your conversation as a spy from Russia, or if I was the MI6 officer trying to find out the latest information about Brexit, you know, if we all recognize each other, then we kind of can't spy on each other, can we? Now, apparently the food is great. In January 2024, somebody put, definitely don't miss it. And another said, good Argentine meat. So if you're into your steak, I think going to Meat Steak and Wine House is probably worth a check out. And for all you know, you may or may not bump into some spies whilst you're there. Just don't accept tea from strangers whilst you're there. So there we go.
Good recommendation. General rule of thumb. Maybe, I don't know, maybe when you're overseas, just don't take any tea that you didn't make yourself. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
I think that's a very wise thing. Yeah. Definitely don't drink. It's a weird one, the whole Litvinenko one. That was a very strange thing, because he was given supposedly tepid cold tea that looked old. It's like, it was very weird. And it was a bit of a weird manners honor thing that came into play, that if he didn't drink the tea, he'd be being rude to his hosts. But obviously, by drinking the tea, he killed himself. It's a very interesting, weird dynamic there where manners come into play and can go against you. But there we go.
Yes.
So yes. Be careful.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back. Moving on from Belgium and from Brussels, we are going to look at a piece that you picked out about Russia setting up fake news sites in the US, which is a very interesting one, that one. So I'll let you run that.
So this is an article from the New York Times. It's called Spate of Mock News Sites with Russian Ties Pop Up in the US. And we have a story that we're going to cover in Extra Shot that's kind of similar to this. Or a specific example of it.
Yeah, so make sure you tune into Extra Shot.
Yes. Recent emergence of fake news websites in the U.S. with names resembling local news outlets is attributed to Russian origins, aiming to disseminate Kremlin propaganda amidst genuine news. These sites, like DC Weekly, New York News Daily, Chicago Chronicle, and the Miami Chronicle, mimic authentic news organizations to push false narratives, exploiting gaps in American journalism. Advancements in technology, including artificial intelligence, facilitate the creation of targeted content, making it easier for Russian actors to manipulate unsuspecting readers. The campaign resembles previous efforts linked to Yevgeny Prigozhin's media empire, RIP, suggesting a continuation of the Kremlin's information battles despite Prigozhin's death. Clemson University researchers exposed Russian connections behind these websites, revealing a pattern of laundering false claims through lesser-known news outlets. They've done this. I mean, they usually do this in like sub-Saharan Africa with stories about the AIDS crisis. Then it gets like laundered its way up to like the New York Times or something. Articles from these sites often contain fabricated content lifted from real news sources or Russian state media to lend an air of credibility and propagate disinformation. The spread of false narratives extends to social media platforms like X, formerly Twitter, Facebook, Telegram, Reddit, Gab, and True Social, amplifying the reach of the disinformation campaign. The ultimate goal of these fake news sites is to influence public opinion, particularly in the context of the upcoming American presidential election, by exploiting vulnerabilities in the media landscape. Chris, what'd you think about this?
Yeah, very interesting piece. Kind of touches on a lot of familiar themes this podcast. Again, good reminder to be careful in what you read and share online. People definitely have to use their due diligence for content online. It's always a good idea to Google the author of the piece or the organization it comes from. Always look at what the author or publication have posted before. Do these things line up with or go against sort of established knowledge or things that you accept to be true? And if they do challenge that, then proceed with extreme caution. So please don't blindly read or share anything, especially, sadly, in this day and age, and especially if you get an emotional reaction from the piece that you're reading.
I was just saying, like, also, if you haven't heard of the outlet before, you know, the site, the newspaper, if it's something that you've never heard of before, you know, take that as something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, trust your doubt.
Definitely, because you've got instincts. Use them, you know, it's definitely there.
And don't doubt something just because it makes you feel uncomfortable or would mean that you were wrong about something that you believed. That's not a reason for doubt.
Yeah, there's good doubt and unhealthy doubt, isn't there? Or healthy skepticism and unhealthy skepticism. And I used to be skeptical of some people's skepticism. Get your head around that one. So you've got to be a bit careful, and especially when dealing with spy stuff and things like that. It's very hard sometimes to determine what's right, wrong, or whatever. And one other interesting thing as well, and it, so you mentioned in the article about how these outlets have logos and name that evoke a bygone era of American journalism. And it's quite interesting because for years, conspiracy theorists and the alt-right have been attacking legacy media, especially the US press and all the traditional media. Yeah, and all traditional media has kind of gone through these shifts in the last 20 years with declining readership numbers and things like that. And so it's become very popular to attack this sort of modern corporate media and then hark back to this kind of past time when people were using typewriters and working in the Daily Planet or something, right. You know. And so it was interesting that they've apparently have gone down this road to make these old logos. One thing that's crossed my mind, though, was they've been a bit lazy because apparently they've used this WordPress software and all these sites look the same. Mm-hmm. It's bizarre that they've done that. And so that, to me, would instantly come across as a bit hinky of like there were three totally different newspapers, unless they openly claim to be owned by the same people, but they don't, do they? They kind of present themselves as completely new, and they've got names. Their names also sound a bit like already established papers. Like I was thinking of the Miami Herald, which is an actual paper, and the other one, what was it called?
The Miami Chronicle.
The Miami Chronicle. That's it.
Also here the Chicago Chronicle, which this article says was a real newspaper that went out of business in the early 20th century.
Ooh, sneaky, sneaky. So you're kind of stealing old brands there. So there we are. So, no, very interesting piece. And I think, again, more cause for concern for the upcoming US elections.
Yeah.
And the British ones, too.
Yeah. I think the biggest problem here is Americans are very easy to deceive, but very difficult to convince them that they've been deceived. A lot of this is just, which is tough because I don't think this advice really is going to apply to many people listening to this. Like, I feel like if you're here already, like you kind of got the right idea, you know? But I don't know, so much of this is just personal responsibility, you know, like it's critical thinking, skills, media literacy, you know, like I said, and the previous, you know, like I don't trust the mainstream media. I do my own research. That's code for you're going to Google around until you find something that just says what you want to believe, regardless of whether or not it stands up to any scrutiny whatsoever, you know? And I think for most, and this is like, I get on Twitter, I often get spun up about the way some stories are covered or the way a headline frames something, especially. And the reason for that is for most people that are just on Facebook, on social media, right, just casually sort of scrolling through, the headlines are the news.
Yeah.
You know, so like, totally. I don't care if your second or third paragraph, like so artfully explains like the nuance and the facts here. No one's reading that shit.
No,
you know,
it happens very frequently, doesn't it? I remember during the Snowden coverage, there'd be some really inflammatory, bold claim. And then by about the seventh paragraph, you would find out that it was just based on a slideshow about a potential theoretical operation or new software that didn't even exist at this point.
Yeah.
But by then everybody's had their hissy fit, thrown their toys out the pram.
Right.
Nobody cares anymore.
Or they have their idea of what feels true to them, you know? Like what are the vibes around this issue?
Yeah.
You know, and that absolutely influences public opinion. I mean, another issue here that you've had come online in the last, you know, year or two that wasn't an issue in 2016 or even in 2020, AI enables this kind of disinformation to be produced at scale with a relatively small and cheap workforce. You know, like, what do you think is cheaper for Putin? To create some of this AstroTurf disinformation BS with the help of AI to, you know, persuade fewer people that attend a Taylor Swift concert spread across a couple states in the Midwest to vote a certain way, and then you've won the war in Ukraine.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, it's funny, actually, I had a note I didn't read out, but, you know, this is why Russia and China use disinformation. It's the cheapest way to win a war, you know, because everybody's fighting each other, which in many ways, American and to some extent British society, we are all fighting each other over something at the moment. And generally, most of that has come from various things that we're pissed off about that are being expressed on the internet. And frequently, I read stuff on the internet and then leave my house a little bit on edge and find by going out into the real world and dealing with real human beings for a few hours that I feel a lot less on edge by the end of that experience than I do before I leave the
house.
Totally. And it just, I think it's just showing what the social media is doing to us.
Another thing there, if there's a media personality or an outlet that you listen to, read, consume in any way, that consistently makes you anxious, upset, nervous, angry, even if it's saying stuff that you agree with, you know, but if it just so enrages you, be skeptical of that. Be suspicious of that. You know, like that's not normal. That's not healthy.
Any emotional reaction is definitely worth noting the frequency and where it's come from, you know, because it's our emotions that kind of bypass sense.
And that's not to say that if you have an emotional reaction to something in the news, that's bad. That's not what I'm saying. But if there is someone or something that you listen to consistently, that every single time you do, you feel a little bit worse about yourself and about the world, even if what they're saying is something you agree with or you want to be true, that's not good.
Well, a good example would be somebody like Alex Jones, who frequently is just screeching about the Illuminati are going to do this, that, and the other. They're turning frogs gay. What else does he talk about? It's all sorts of weird shit that he comes up with.
Everyone I don't like is a pedophile.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
And he's always shouting, always episodes. He sometimes starts calm, but by the end of it, he's always like, bruh! You know, it's got this. And that's not healthy for him, and it's not healthy for anybody listening to it. And it definitely, it's just definitely not rational. Now, there are people out there who do avoid the news because it makes them feel bad. And I think there's a danger as well where, if you avoid the, you know, if you avoid legacy news, whatever, like if you avoid the BBC or just refuse to watch the news, then there's a danger you become misinformed. And then that could also make you susceptible to nonsense too.
You may, I think in that case, such a person may think they're avoiding the news, but I would bet in a way they're not. I bet it filters through in social media, through conversations, through podcasts, through other means. And the stuff that filters through is probably this kind of manufactured disinformation shit.
Totally.
You may not seek it out, but it'll find you because people want to ensure that it finds you.
Yeah, so it's the alt-right space. So I have one or two friends, God bless them, who do avoid the news because it makes them feel bad. But then frequently, once in a while, they will quote something from maybe Joe Rogan or something. And I'm like, yeah, that's not good. And then I try my very best to delicately talk about why whatever the particular point was probably doesn't stack up.
It's an inability also, I think, or an unwillingness to recognize even because something doesn't present itself as political doesn't mean it's not political.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think about like people who were saying that like the last Top Gun movie, they were like, oh, I loved it because they kept politics out of it. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, that Top Gun Maverick is one of the most intensely political movies of the 21st century.
Yeah.
It's just in service of an ideology you agree with and find and presented in a nostalgic way that you find comforting. And I mean, I'm right there with you. I like the movie. Yeah. It's in service of an ideology that I agree with. I thought it was cool, but it's still political. Like the Navy had recruiters outside the theaters when the first one came out.
Yeah.
Like it is absolutely a political movie. You know, but just because it doesn't upset you, it doesn't enrage you, it doesn't mean that it's not pushing a message.
Mm. What is it? A lot of people bang on about the woke. I hate to use the word woke now. I'm just so tired of that word. But the woke agenda in films. The thing is, like, a lot of movies are pushing agendas of some sort or another, whether you're aware of it or not. And usually, I think maybe in the past, writing was a touch subtler, so you weren't always as aware of it as you are now. So like Star Trek is a good example. I think Star Trek, the early years, is a very liberal show. It always has been. And some of the writing I felt was a lot smarter in the way it brought liberal messaging across than maybe in some of the more recent shows. where it's really in your face now. And it's quite interesting that, and it's
Well, look at the original Star Wars trilogy. Mm-hmm. It's straight up the Vietnam War. Like the Ewoks are the Viet Cong. Like Lucas literally said as much.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's everywhere. Yeah. And just because you think you're sitting down and you know going into your happy little space where there's nothing it's there.
Yeah. Well, I've been in writing classes where because I'm trying to do stuff that's not so masked, because I'm interested in espionage. So I'm trying to do contemporary espionage thrillers and dramas, a bit like the kind of, you know, the Tom Clancy movies of the 90s or what have you. I like that kind of stuff like you do. Mm-hmm. And when I've been in a few writing classes, I've had the odd teacher. So I did a course on using AI as a writing assistant last year. Okay. And AI, as if you use ChatGTP, as these terms of services that come up, should you bring up certain scenarios? So I was throwing in some like story about an MI6 operative undercover in Al-Qaeda and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And when I asked ChatGTP to help me come up with a character biog or whatever, it just stopped and said, you violated our terms and blah, blah, blah. And you can't proceed any further. So my tutor then said, well, Chris, set it in space, change the name. So like Al-Qaeda is now like the Martian faction and the MI6 officer is like the Jupiter faction or something like that. And after he said that, he then said, but really, you want to write sci-fi because sci-fi is where you can talk about the real world. And it was like, and I get what he's saying. And yes, good sci-fi does talk about the real world. But at the same time, especially, I suppose, if you write stuff that you think is about something in particular, I feel like sometimes people do miss the point of things. And so sometimes you have to be a bit more direct about it. And I don't know what it was. It got my back up a little bit, that comment about you probably want to write sci-fi. I love sci-fi, but I don't want to have to be forced to write it if I don't want to. Does that make sense? And it's totally not this on topic anymore. But
yeah, it should. No, I get it. And nothing like after a couple whiskeys, nothing is more guaranteed to send me off into a rage than the topic of like people who don't like when spy novels get political. Like I will throw stuff across the room if I hear that. Like, what do you think all of this is for?
Well, we get comments about this. Oh, God forbid your podcast is political. Well, we're dealing with espionage. It is political.
Nation states doing what? Politics.
So it always cracks me up occasionally, get the one-star review. It was great till it got political.
The whole concept of one nation state that is in this imaginary part of the map, and on that side of the line is another nation state that controls that side of the map. That's fucking politics.
Yeah. So I think people need to have a bit of an education about what is what politics actually is, and that's how
like in the Tom Cruise Top Gun movies, you know, you just get like generic bad guys with the cockpit of the fighter pilot with the visor down, and you can't see their skin color, anything. Yeah. They're just bad guys. Don't ask questions.
That was the only thing I didn't like about Top Gun Maverick was what they called the enemy. Well, they just called the enemy. I can't remember what they called them.
The enemy.
Yeah, the enemy, and it's just such. To me, it was such nonsense, that bit. But the rest of it was great. And did you know, I don't know if you know this, the airstrike it was that they used as the model for the film was the Israeli airstrike against an Iraqi nuclear facility, I believe it was. Because Jerry Bruckheimer has been wanting to make a film about that for years, apparently.
God, what was the name of that? I don't know, was it...
Mm.
There was a nuclear, was it a new, there was like a big, there was like a huge artillery gun, artillery gun that the Iraqis were building back in the, back before the Gulf War.
The super guns.
Yes. That was going to be big enough to.
An English guy got arrested for
That was going to be big enough to like shell, Tel Aviv. And I think they blew that up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there we go. We kind of went off topic, but stayed on topic somehow as well. So is there anything else to add to that? Because it's a very good piece, Matt. So thank you for pointing that out.
No, yeah, I would pay attention to this. This is only the beginning of this. Before November, there's going to be There's going to be so much shit. I think the most important thing to do is to talk about it again, like with the Russians, with the nukes, name and shame. Talk about it often, talk about it loudly, let people know like what these outlets are, you know? These disinformation efforts, they thrive in darkness. More you talk about them, the longer you talk about them, the more people are aware of them, the less effective they are. Like I said, it's very easy to deceive Americans. It's very hard to convince them that they've been deceived.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. And that's on both sides of the spectrum, believe it or not, because there's a lot of stuff in the far left space. There's a lot of stuff in the far left space. It's complete bullshit that people frequently use to form opinions. And it always, and I'm always, the reason why I always bang about left is, you know, I identify as center leftist, so I'm more aware of what's going on the left than I am sometimes the right. Or at least with the spaces. I don't hang out in right wing spaces, but I do keep an eye on left wing ones. And I'm always amazed when having conversations with friends who are quite left wing, who come out with some, like the Russians are really, you know, dealing with neo-Nazis nonsense. That is a very popular idea. It was a very popular idea on the far left, especially in 2014. And it came from all sorts of weird spaces, from Open Democracy. Is it Open Democracy? Open Democracy. There was a nonsense website called Neon Nestle. There's another one called Navara Media, which is a very far left kind of website that, you know, sometimes publishes some very good stuff, but most of the time it's publishing some very sketchy things, usually of a slightly Russian disinfo persuasion. And those are sort of websites where things then do eke into the mainstream. And in legacy, the other problem is legacy media is now trying to always stay relevant. And the danger is it then looks to what people talk about online to stay relevant. And then that's where the Overton window can change. Because if suddenly the entire population believe a load of nonsense, then the news media is going to have to kind of shift over to kind of keep up with said population, because that's your audience. And so then nonsense becomes reality. So, you know, there we are. It's a lot of philosophy books we've written about that.
That's what happened with one side, but
indeed. Well, talk about things that aren't political but are political. Let's go to Antarctica.
Things that shouldn't be political but are, for 400 hours.
So I'll start with there's a really good piece in Axios about Antarctica and about how it's getting more political. So I'll just talk a bit about that. So there's a myth that Antarctica is isolated from politics, but politics is just done through science, says science historian Peter Roberts of the University of Stavanger in Norway. And so scientific research has for decades guided the governance of Antarctica, offering access to scientific frontiers and a say in the course of the continent. But as countries grow their presence on Antarctica, a wide range of politics and goals is intersecting with polar science. China's establishment of a fifth research center in Antarctica is a good example, or good recent example of that. The station's location is to the south of Australia, and it's raised concerns among some analysts that it could be used for intelligence gathering on US allies. Interestingly as well, Iran has recently claimed it has property rights in the South Pole and plans to carry out military and scientific work on the continent. So there's a new one there. And scientific expeditions have found valuable minerals in Antarctica, such as copper, gold, uranium, and zinc. And Antarctica is still the only continent on Earth where no mining has taken place. And this is partly due to the extreme weather and ice that covers the surface. And with climate change, that could change, and there is a possibility that countries may start to look at mining options. The Antarctic Treaty, which prioritizes scientific research and cooperation, is increasingly intersecting with broader political goals. And the potential impact won't be just felt on an environmental level. So, Matt, I don't know if you have any thoughts about Antarctica and kind of what's kind of developing there.
My first thought after reading this was how, like, I guess it's a shame that, like, great power ambitions grate against, like, the unself-interested, I'll say, desire for, like, scientific research and exploration that benefits just all of humanity, you know? Like, it's not for, like, this country. It's just for, like, everybody, right? Then I think, like, then again, you know, what was the space race? what ultimately brought about the moon landing. It was all competition with the Soviets and about, like, developing dual-use technologies that could be used for ICBMs. You know, so...
Yeah.
In a way, maybe that's just how it's always been, you know? And we're just now, like, in a way, our current moment is no different. Like, we're just entering a period where other new and different nations are able to compete in this sphere, and they're going to take advantage of that, you know? And maybe that's just the realist in me talking. I don't know.
Yeah. I think you're very much right. I mean, there was a podcast I did a few years ago called Spies of the Deep with William Craig Reed, and he pointed out that the US is sort of falling behind in its Arctic and Antarctic capabilities in comparison to Russia and China. In particular, the Arctic came up a lot in that conversation. And he believed that with global warming and ice melting, that there will be new kind of shipping routes that will come out. And those shipping routes will obviously be more economical to use, but Russia will be in a position to kind of enforce who can and can't use those shipping routes.
It's not like the Northern Passages, right?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah. It's still not quite in my area. I need to do a bit more homework on all this. But I brought it up because I thought that the Arctic and Antarctic is something to be looking at, because it's definitely the area that's used, pardon me, bad analogy, heating up a bit at the moment in the world. Not because of global warming particularly, but more because of all the political things going on.
Well, in many ways, that's because of global warming. Like, you look at, like, those northern passages through the Arctic. This isn't Antarctica, but if you look up north, it's sea lanes that one could get from Europe or North America or the Middle East, and maybe not so much the Middle East, but from, like, Europe through to China by going up, like, north along Russia's northern coast and back down to China. Because of global warming, those sea lanes aren't frozen over year round, or are even open, or could be open through icebreakers and stuff all year.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so with William Craig Reed, he was concerned that if America don't get their act together on this, that America could kind of, in a sense, miss out on some of this and could end up being beholden on Russian permissions and stuff like that. So,
yeah. Canada has a role to play here, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And they probably, and I need to look in, I'm sure Canada probably do have a capability here. But there was an interesting other article in Forbes that points out now that Sweden and Finland have joined NATO, that maybe it's time for a polar AUKUS involving Sweden and Finland, because they've got capabilities with all this that are much better than what America have at the moment. So,
it's their corner of the world.
Yeah, so I think there's definitely something, this is definitely an area to keep an eye on. So that's why I wanted to bring it up today. I'm not a massive expert in this area, but I did want to just bring it up just purely for that. So I've got one more piece for Espresso Martini, and then we'll move over to Extra Shot. So this last piece here is from the Nordic Monitor, and it's about how Turkey is reportedly escalating its covert intelligence activities in Europe and North America. So I'll just do my best to summarize some of this. So an 8-page document obtained by the Nordic Monitor reveals extensive details about a large-scale spying operation conducted by the Turkish National Intelligence Organization, known as MIT, on behalf of the Turkish government. Turkish intelligence operations run out of consulates in the West, notably in Europe and North America, and have intensified targeting critics and opponents of President Erdogan. And these operations include surveillance, information gathering, and mapping out of daily routines of targets, with the potential for further aggressive actions. Classified documents reveal extensive spying efforts involving multiple Turkish intelligence services across numerous foreign countries. The document listed 82 unsuspecting individuals as targets. So that implies that thousands of people have actually been profiled for it to get to that 82. President Erdogan has been increasingly dependent on intelligence services to maintain his repressive regime in Turkey, and he suppresses critical voices and has cracked down on opposition groups. The increased surveillance and intelligence gathering activities abroad are aimed at intimidating opponents overseas, perpetuating a climate of fear among Turkish diaspora groups, and influencing the foreign and domestic policies of host countries. And then just to finish up, the surveillance activities obviously raise concerns of potential escalation, including violence and kidnapping, echoing previous attempts implicating Turkish intelligence in Europe and the US. And despite measures taken by European nations against Turkish operations, the Erdogan government persists in its covert operations, deploying more spies abroad, often under diplomatic cover, to gather intelligence. So, Matt, I don't know if you had any thoughts on all that.
In many ways, Turkey has been like the ultimate frenemy for a while. I mean, they're a NATO ally. They're a nominally Western country. I mean, that's always sort of been, they've had one foot in both worlds since Ataturk, and they kind of historically at least have wanted it that way. Part of Erdogan's sort of philosophy, if you can call it that, is just like neo-Ottomanism, right? Which is a belief that Turkey should shift away from the Western world and be more the leading governing force in the Middle East the way it was during the Ottoman Empire, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
In some ways, if there's stability and order that can be brought to the region through that, if, you know, I'd rather the Middle East be, you know, if the Middle East must be dominated by someone, I'd rather it be Turkey than Iran, you know? I don't know.
Yeah.
There's complicated feelings there. But Erdogan has decided since that coup in 2016, that failed coup attempt, he sort of decided that it's in his domestic political interest to situate the country somewhat against NATO and the West, or at least to like be a thorn in the side, you know, like he's still on the team, but it's sort of like sometimes it's like, you know, with friends like these, who needs enemies? I don't know. They have played an important role. Like they've played, especially in the early days of the war in Ukraine, Turkey played a very important role as a mediator, you know, and it's good.
And I think they've restricted Russian naval access to the region, haven't they?
Yeah, through the Bosphorus. But yeah, he's decided that it's sort of in his interest to orient Turkey somewhat against that, or to at least sort of play two sides, much in the same way that Saudi Arabia under Mohammed bin Salman has been doing, you know, where they're still on our side, you know, they're even now, you know, the Saudis are seeking a somewhat formal treaty alliance with the United States, which I find pretty surprising. Whereas in the same point, talking about buying all kinds of arms with China and having closer diplomatic ties with China, I think that's just a lot of these middle powers kind of hedging their bets, you know, because which way the U.S. is going to go is kind of still up in the air, unfortunately. It's like you have the French saying, you know, we need to have positive economic relations with China. You know, they're hedging their bets for whichever way this goes. And in a way, yeah, that's understandable. I think in a sense, Turkey is probably doing that also. The other thing here is allies spy on each other all the time. I mean, the U.S. spies on everybody except Five Eyes countries. You know, like you guys, Australia, Canada, you're the only ones we're not spying against. As far as like, if we're talking about MI6 spying on the EU during the Brexit negotiations, like the US has gotten in trouble a couple times now for spying on the Germans, you know, tapping Angela Merkel's cell phone. And
I would be spying on the Germans at the moment.
Yeah. But. And that's not, it's not like, you know, it's not something you want, you know, spelled out in like Der Spiegel. You know, that's not good. It's embarrassing. You know, it's awkward, but those operations, they're not meant to harm Germany. You know, they're not meant to steal their industrial property, you know, to get a leg up on them on scientific capabilities. We just want to know what they're talking about amongst themselves when they close the door.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think in many ways, part of this, what Turkey's doing, it's that. It's being more aggressive and assertive with those intelligence efforts. A lot of it is, you know, when it's about Fethullah Gulen, who's that dissident who lives in little town up in the Poconos in Pennsylvania called Broadheadsville.
Oh yes. Yeah,
they just want to keep an eye on and crush dissidents overseas, you know, much in the same way that the that the Chinese do.
As you've said, Turkey spying abroad is hardly a shock, but it is concerning when those spies are profiling Turkish nationals abroad and then looking, looking to gather information that could lead to sanctions, legal trouble, and possible harassment of family members, or worse, could lead to their murder, because there was a murder in London in 1994. Remember the Turkish trade unionist who had links to the PKK and he was living in London? And on that fateful day, he was playing backgammon in a cafe located in Newington Green. And he was shot in the back of the head, and he was shot by a Turkish national who was a sort of known gangster operating in London, who was sort of hired by MIT to carry out the assassinations. There was a bit of a cutout there. And then also, more recently, MIT have been connected to murders of PKK members in Paris.
Sure.
And obviously in Turkey and Syria and other places.
Germany,
so yeah, they are, you know, a bit like the Russians using lethal operations against some of their enemies abroad. And I don't think that's good or healthy. Yes, okay, you could argue, well, they're just targeting Turkish people or with Russia. As one former MI6 head once said, that Russia are just targeting Russians. So generally, it doesn't affect other people, uh-huh. But it does. It does affect things. So yeah, it's not.
Yeah. Well, there was that scheme with the Michael, and this article talks about this a bit, that Michael Flynn was involved in during the like 2 seconds that he was Trump's national security advisor, that Turkey wanted Fethullah Gulen back because he's a dissident and criticizing Erdogan, and they don't like that. And the Justice Department basically said, like, no, because he's not, like, it's not against U.S. law to criticize the Turkish president. You know, so like we can't just throw a black bag over his head and disappear him back to you. Like, he has to commit a crime that we see as a crime, and just criticizing Erdogan is not a crime. And, you know, to the contrary, Mike Flynn was like, okay, we'll throw a black bag over his head and just disappear him for you. That plan never came to fruition. And that's something else that, like, he's never been charged for that. I've never heard of like anything coming of that. And it's like, you hear that and it's like, how are you not charged for that? I don't know.
Yeah, my speculative thoughts on that. So associates of his were charged, because I looked into this too and I couldn't find a definitive answer of how it concluded. And obviously it was through the Mueller investigation that brought this up. So I wonder if this was put on the table that led to his deal. That led to him testifying.
Plea deal, yeah.
And so it kind of disappeared. I could be wrong, but because legally speaking, Flynn was not guilty of this, but his associates have been found guilty. And it's a bit sketchy. But what's also weird as well is Flynn is also quite anti-Erdogan from what I've seen, because he was charged as being a foreign agent for Turkey, but for the opposition of Turkey.
That's weird.
So it is weird. So I find it's all a bit murky, Mike Flynn's relationship with Turkey, but it was all around about 2017. This all kind of was reported.
Yeah, there's a lot that's murky about Mike Flynn. I think he's one of the most dangerous people in the country.
Yeah.
And we have not taken a serious enough stance against him.
No, it's a bit of an interesting one. Yeah. Quick note, why would I spy on Germany? So the only reason I said I'd spy on Germany, not to offend any German listeners, but I would be very interested in the Russian penetration of Germany at the moment. I think there's a lot of evidence to say that the Russians are co-opting members, people who have far-right allegiances in Germany. And obviously there's been some arrests over the last year connected to members of the BND who may have had far-right leanings. And also, the traditional sort of left in Germany seem to also be very pro-Russia. So I think there definitely is evidence of Russian agents working quite heavily in Germany to try and persuade the German public to become more anti-NATO and less pro-Ukrainian. So that's why I would spy on the Germans.
I want to echo that point there to what you were saying. It's not these efforts to spy on allies, even close allies. It's not done to harm the ally. It's like, we want to know what you're talking about behind closed doors when we're not there. Basically, it's being nosy, you know, And are, you know, citizens of that country right to be uncomfortable or upset about it? Totally. You know, totally get it. Countries spy on each other. It's their job to try and stop it. That said, I'm sure there are many Western European countries that are spying on the US's domestic political situation, trying to get intelligence of what's going on behind the scenes. And if they're not, they should be.
No, definitely. I think, you know, I think Britain certainly must be up to something on that front. But yeah, I would definitely be spying on America myself if I was head of MI6. I'd be like, right, we need to know what's going on, you know, especially in the Trump campaign and all that. What's going on there? How is he being real when he says he's going to, let Russia invade certain NATO countries, etc.? Or is that just sort of bravado, you know?
And MI6... would be doing that if they are doing it, which the legality of, I don't know, MI6 might be tough for them to actually do that. I don't know.
It probably is a cutout.
Yeah. Let's say for the sake of conversation that they are. MI6 would be doing that because they want the US to remain a liberal democracy, small d democracy, and a productive leader of the Western world. The same reason that you gave your example of why you would want to spy on Germany and their, you know, efforts to combat Russian penetration in the far right, because you want Germany to remain a healthy liberal democracy and productive leader of the Western world. That's why.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. So that's why you should spy on your friends once in a while.
But everyone does it. Don't tell me you don't.
Well, we all keep an eye out in case somebody's got a bit... Yeah, actually, Facebook is quite good for that, where a friend sort of posts something and you think, that seems a bit odd. So you just
call another friend and be like, did you see what so-and-so just posted? Did you hear something about check. That? That's what it is. We're just using satellites and tapping people's cell phones to do it.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. Well, on that note, I think we will move over to Extra Shot. So thank you, Matt. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And if you want to join us in Extra Shot, please do. You just need to become a Patreon subscriber. And on Extra Shot, we will be looking at how to run a CIA station abroad, SAS soldiers accused of murder, reports that the king has died, and more. So join us there. Take care. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.